Today is Thursday, December 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, House Democrats and Republicans sparred Wednesday evening as they made their cases for and against impeaching President Trump.
I know that nobody is above the law, but the law means nothing. If the accused, whether the man who breaks in your house or the president, can destroy evidence, stop witnesses from testifying, and blatantly refuse to cooperate in the investigation.
Plus, North Korea says Washington has nothing to offer it to get back to the negotiation table. Those stories and more are next. The House of Representatives Judiciary Committee took the first steps Wednesday evening toward voting on articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump, beginning a marathon two-day session to consider the historic charges with a lively primetime hearing at the Capitol. Democrats and Republicans used the otherwise procedural meeting to deliver sharp, poignant, and at times personal arguments for and against impeachment. Both sides appeal to Americans' sense of history. Republican Representative Matt Gaetz called the impeachment garbage.
After years of pointless and endless investigations against the president, this witch hunt is no longer simply troublesome. It has become deeply and excruciatingly tiresome. It's time to move on. The American people hate this, and it's making some of them hate us.
While Democrat Representative Hakeem Jeffries said they must defend democracy.
We must hold this president accountable for his stunning abuse of power. We must hold this president accountable for undermining America's national security. We must hold this president accountable for corrupting our democracy.
Now, for more insight on the implications of the impeachment hearings, I spoke with Stephen Farnsworth, political science professor at the University of Mary Washington.
Well, I mean, ultimately, everyone is behaving as they have behaved throughout this process. The Republicans are very supportive of the president, and the Democrats are very critical of the president. The process is, I think, not particularly conducive to putting people at their best. And so the openness of American politics, I think, often leads to moments that might be a little wild. But I suppose it does make interesting television for people around the world.
So what does this do in terms of the democratic process in the United States? Because essentially it is a two-party system. The committee is set up that way with a majority and a minority, and this is a political process. So what's the more long-lasting impact of something like this?
Yeah, I do think that that's an important point to make. When we think about impeachment, it is important to remember that it is not a legal process. You don't have the same kinds of standards that you would have in a court case in terms of the evidence that's presented or rebuttal witnesses or compelling people to testify. There are a whole series of things that are very different about this process from a court case. And with that in the background, what you end up with, I think, is an idea that you really do see America as very divided. Many of the people in the House were elected in districts that are overwhelmingly Republican in orientation or overwhelmingly Democratic. And so there isn't all that much of an electorate that focuses on the center in many of these districts. And in fact, the Judiciary Committee in particular has some of the most ideologically committed members of the House on it. So the result is a very contentious process that will clearly lead to greater partisan division, however this story ends.
Republicans have charged that this process is moving too fast. Well, Democrats counter that they feel that the president presents a danger to democracy. What is your interpretation of those two arguments?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the conversation that the Democrats are putting forward focuses on the 2020 election and the extent to which the president may have tried to solicit international efforts to try to manipulate the American system. Now, our laws and traditionally our system has been very, very much designed to insulate domestic concerns. That is, the voters get to decide the presidential election rather than having these outside international influences. And so the reality is that the 2020 election is already underway. And so the idea of pushing it further back in time, I think, creates more problems, not fewer problems. And so the challenge, I think, for the argument that this can be delayed or that it's moving too fast is the reality of the timetable. This could have happened faster if the White House had been willing to release more testimony, willing to release more documents sooner. But so far, those obstacles have slowed the process down. I think the Democrats, quite frankly, have made a wise choice in terms of a very slimmed-down vision of what impeachment could be. If you think about the two articles that are being debated in Congress this week, it could have been eight articles or even more in terms of what was being discussed before the Democrats on the committee made their decision about what ideas to put forward.
Stephen Farnsworth is a political science professor at the University of Mary Washington. Thank you very much for sharing your insight today.
Thank you.
The U.S. Department of Justice's Inspector General Michael Horowitz told lawmakers that he and a U.S. prosecutor conducting a separate review disagreed about a fundamental question about the political sensitive Russia probe inquiry. Horowitz concluded that the FBI had enough evidence in 2016 to open a full counterintelligence investigation of possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. Prosecutor John Durham told Horowitz last month that he believed the FBI should have opened a more limited investigation. He said he was not swayed by Durham's argument. Attorney General William Barr, who was appointed by Republican President Donald Trump, has repeatedly criticized the FBI's investigation and assigned Durham in May to examine it, while Horowitz's review was already underway. Democrats have accused Durham's review of being politically motivated. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, former Obama administration Attorney General Eric Holder criticized Barr for making a series of public statements and actions that Holder called ideological, partisan, and deeply inappropriate. Attorney General Barr has not responded. Thousands of people took to the streets in central Algiers on Thursday, chanting, "No vote, we want freedom," as authorities held a presidential election at a mass protest movement views as a charade intended to keep the ruling elite in power. The army, the strongest political player, sees the election as the only way to restore order by naming a successor to Abdel Aziz Bouteflika, who was toppled by a popular uprising earlier this year after two decades in office. Chilean lawmakers are set to debate on Thursday a move to impeach President Sebastián Piñera over allegations that he failed to safeguard human rights during a week-long of rioting. Israelis grappled Thursday with the confounding reality of unprecedented third national elections in less than a year after parliament dissolved and the date for the next vote was set, further extending months of political paralysis. For more on this development, I spoke with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
It's never happened before. In fact, there's never been two elections in one year, let alone three. And it happened for a series of political reasons. And basically, none of the major parties was able to get a majority, which is what often happens. A lot of there are so many different political parties in Israel that nobody's able to get an outright majority, and usually they form a coalition with various parties. And even with those coalitions, nobody was able to get to the magic number of 61, which would have given them a majority. Now, the most logical thing would be a unity government between the two largest parties, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud and a new party called Blue and White, which is a centrist party headed by the former chief of staff. And there were constant negotiations since the last election in order to do that. The president of Israel, President Rivlin, was really pushing it, and the negotiations foundered over between the two men who would be prime minister first and how long, and it just kind of fell apart over all of those details.
So as we move to this next election, has anything substantially changed? Should, you know, we get in a similar situation after the next election?
Well, one major change has been that Netanyahu has been indicted in a series of corruption charges. And a lot of sort of cynical Israeli analysts said that it was really Netanyahu who was pushing for the new election because he wants to go into his trial as the prime minister. And he will continue to be prime minister until there's a new election. He's being challenged, by the way, from within the Likud by someone named Gideon Saar, who's a young, a much younger, dynamic politician. And there's going to be sort of a primary leadership contest at the end of this month. So what may change is that Netanyahu may no longer be the head of the Likud. What won't change is that Israelis are really divided on major issues such as, you know, the future of politics and what should be going on with the Palestinians, what kind of economy Israel should have. However, early polls, and again, this is very early and polls change a lot, show that the Likud has lost support, that voters blame Netanyahu for this election, and the centrist former chief of staff, Benny Gantz, has had an increase in support. But it's a long way between now and March 2020.
Given that polls can often change, and you're right, they do, and there's a whole lot of time between now and those March election date. But if Netanyahu is no longer the head of the Likud party, is that enough if we get the similar result that there could be a unity government formed?
Yes. In other words, one of the obstacles to a unity government this time around was that Gantz was saying that Netanyahu would have to resign as soon as his trial began. And Netanyahu had refused to do that. It's never happened before that a sitting Israeli prime minister has been put on trial. There have been, in the past, there was one prime minister indicted, but he stepped down before his trial began.
Interesting developments. Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
British voters are deciding today who they want to resolve the stalemate over Brexit in a parliamentary election seen as one of the most important since the end of World War II. Voting is underway across the country in a contest that pits Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who says he will take Britain out of the European Union by January 31st, against opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, who promises another referendum on Brexit. With so much at stake, political parties have pushed the boundaries of truth, transparency, and reality during the 5 weeks of campaigning. Johnson's Conservative Party was criticized for using misleading tactics on social media, while Corbyn's Labour Party sought to win votes by promising to tax the rich, boost government spending, and nationalize industries such as railroads and water companies. Opinion polls have consistently shown Johnson's Conservative Party in the lead, but recent surveys suggest the margin may have narrowed in the final days of campaigning. While Corbyn's Labour Party is unlikely to win an outright majority, smaller opposition parties hope to win enough seats so they can team with Labour to block Johnson's Brexit plans. Election results are expected early Friday morning. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
As NASA continues to work toward its goal of returning people to the moon by 2024, the space agency is also looking further into the future with its plans of someday landing humans on Mars. A number of challenges must first be met before people can travel to and actually function on the red planet. Among them is picking the right landing spot. A major consideration in picking a location is that it should offer a ready supply of natural resources, such as water, that would be used for not only human consumption, but also for the generation of energy. A new study from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory could help in this selection process by providing a map of where water ice, located in as little as 2.5 centimeters below the surface, can be found. Data from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey Orbiter was used to create the Mars Water Map. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. North Korea said Thursday that the United States had nothing to offer for possible renewed talks aimed at getting Pyongyang to give up its nuclear and missile programs after Washington said it was ready to take concrete steps towards securing a deal. It criticized the United States for convening a UN Security Council meeting on Wednesday, calling it a foolish thing, which would help Pyongyang to make a clear decision on which path it would take. The 15-member Security Council met as concerns grow internationally that North Korea could resume nuclear or long-range missile testing suspended since 2017 because denuclearization talks between Pyongyang and Washington have stalled. Now, to break things down in this latest development, I spoke earlier with Harry Kazianis, Korean Studies Director at the Center for the National Interest.
You know, I think comments like that, at least for now, I'm going to attribute to domestic politics in North Korea. I think it's very clear that Kim Jong-un, probably wounded a little bit from what happened in Hanoi and not getting a deal after traveling thousands of miles by train, and essentially foreshadowing in North Korean media, we forget that it looked like he thought he was going to come away with a deal, still has to feel and show that he is going to be tough towards the United States. The question now is, what will Kim do for his supposed Christmas gift to Donald Trump? He's declared this year-end deadline. Everybody wants to know what he's going to do. There's only two paths. One, he tests an ICBM or nuclear weapon, sparks a crisis. Or two, if he does something below that threshold, I think his restraint would be rewarded. When Donald Trump comes out of impeachment, I think he's going to be looking for a big foreign policy win. That win could be North Korea, but I think it's up to Kim at this point.
Do you really think that anything less than a nuclear test or an ICBM launch would be rewarded, because he hasn't been rewarded for the short-range tests in the past? I mean, the United States says that doesn't violate the agreement that they have, but it hasn't moved the needle toward negotiations, even with Special Representative Steve Biegun slated to be in Seoul next week.
I think the timing here is the key, I think, more than anything else. I think we have just a very unique set of circumstances that haven't happened prior. I think Kim, in a way, has sort of boxed himself in by this year-end deadline. He knows he has to do something. At the same time, U.S. domestic politics is actually quite interesting these days, with impeachment and a potential very quick Senate trial. So if everything to work out perfectly, if Kim was to do something below that ICBM or nuclear threshold, maybe a satellite launch, maybe a intermediate range ballistic missile test, there's lots of ways that you could sort of thread that needle. And if Donald Trump chooses not to respond, not going crazy on Twitter or something like that, I think after he gets through impeachment, Trump is going to need some sort of foreign policy win. Because let's face it, a lot of his other foreign policy gambits, whether it was Syria, Iran, they have not been transformative. So I think for him, I think North Korea is the obvious choice. And I think everybody knows what the contours of that deal look like. It's something very similar to Hanoi. The closure of Yongbyon, the full nuclear facility for some sort of temporary or snapback provisions in terms of sanctions relief. I think that's the deal that could be done. I think that's the deal that builds trust. I know a lot of people won't like that deal because it doesn't go to full towards denuclearization right off the bat. But if we're looking to achieve something that can change the status quo between Pyongyang and Washington, that's the deal. But a lot of things have to happen for that to fall through and make it happen. So we'll have to see.
Harry Kazianis is the Director of Korean Studies over at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you very much for your insight today.
Always a pleasure.
Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi returned to the International Court of Justice today to defend Myanmar against accusations it committed genocide against its Rohingya Muslim minority population. Gambia, which brought the suit at the UN's top court under the 1948 Genocide Convention, has asked judges to order provisional measures that would act as a kind of restraining order for the Myanmar military until the case is heard in full. Lawyer Paul Riker spoke for Gambia.
Myanmar has not denied that the UN fact-finding mission reached this conclusion. There is no reasonable conclusion to draw other than the inference of genocidal intent from the state's pattern of conduct. Nor has Myanmar denied that the fact-finding mission reached this conclusion based on seven specific indicators which it found to be, quote, indicators of genocidal intent in the international case law.
Suu Kyi and her team will have several hours to formulate a rebuttal and final statement. The Nobel Prize laureate called Gambia's case yesterday incomplete and misleading. The court has not set a date for a decision on provisional measures, but one could come in January. After the decision on provisional measures, the process may continue to a full case that could last several years. Two people were being treated in the hospital after the eruption of New Zealand's White Island volcano have died. Phil Mercer reports that brings the official number of dead in the disaster to 8.
The volcano on White Island in New Zealand's Bay of Plenty erupted without warning Monday. At least 47 visitors from around the world, including many from Australia, were on the island at the time of 2 explosions. So far, 8 people have died in the disaster, but the death toll will increase. 9 people are still officially missing and are presumed to be dead. A group of hikers was seen near the rim of the crater just moments before the blasts. Several bodies remain on the island, but recovery teams have been unable to reach them because of the risk of another eruption. The volcano is considered to be too unstable and sent plumes of ash and smoke billowing more than 3 kilometres into the sky. Sarah Stewart-Black is New Zealand Civil Defence Emergency Management Director.
This is an utterly tragic situation. We all agree that retrieving bodies of the deceased from the island is an absolute imperative. Every day that passes with those bodies unrecovered is a day of anguish for their loved ones who have been affected. We recognise this and we are doing everything we can.
20 people are in intensive care with severe burns. Some are so badly injured that they're unable to identify themselves. 5 have been flown to Australia for treatment. Among the dead are teenage Australian brothers Matthew and Berent Hollander. The alert level at the popular tourist destination off New Zealand's North Island was recently raised, indicating moderate to heightened volcanic unrest. Officials had said there was no direct hazard to visitors. New Zealand sits on the Pacific Ring of Fire, a region notorious for its intense volcanic activity and earthquakes. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As Phil Mercer mentioned, some of the bodies in the hospital are severely burned. In response, Australia has donated more than 1.8 square meters of skin to help the victims. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has that part of the story.
It's among donations to save victims severely burned by a volcanic eruption this week. However, it's only a fraction of what New Zealand's ordered, nearly 1,300 square feet of skin. In the wake of Monday's deadly event, surgeons have been working around the clock to treat survivors at hospitals around the country. The head of one Australian tissue bank explained why the skin is so critical.
So skin is used in life-saving surgery. So skin is predominantly used in patients who have the most life-threatening burns. Usually if they have more than 50% burn over their body, there isn't enough of their own skin to transplant onto the bone burn wounds. So in that case, there is no alternative.
The death toll has been rising through the week, and more than 20 people are in intensive care. Another 8 are presumed dead on the island. The amount of skin needed to save victims equates to about 60 donors. However, the New Zealand Herald reports that only 5 to 10 people donate skin each year in the country. Jorge Villapalos, a lead surgeon for plastics and grafting in London, says when the donations do arrive, surgeons will be tested to the limits of their expertise.
What we need to analyze here is that these are exceptional circumstances by all stretch of the imagination. And to illustrate this, I would say that our colleagues in New Zealand have had maybe the work of a whole year thrown at them in a single day.
On Thursday, Maori prayers were offered for victims of the tragedy. Authorities confirmed that they plan to recover victims' bodies from White Island Friday morning. Previous efforts have been deemed unsafe, as experts say there's a 50 to 60% chance of another eruption.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. An angry mob killed a 16-year-old and strung up the corpse by its feet from a traffic pole after the teen shot and killed 6 people Thursday, including 4 anti-government protesters, according to Iraqi officials. The violence underscored the growing fears and suspicions swirling around an 8-week-old protest movement, which engulfed Iraq from October 1st when thousands took to the street to decry government corruption, poor services, and scarcity of jobs. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Patrick Dea, and managing editor Paul Alexander, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.